The next case is Build It and They Will Drink versus Strouch, set for 1/2 hour. Both parties ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Just let me remind you of what, I don't know if you heard me before, but one, this is housekeeping. Justice Designate Marquez, provided she doesn't have a conflict, will be joining us on December 10th, and she will listen to the tapes and participate in the decision. And secondly, we will attempt to enforce the 15-minute rule in this case.
Attempt.
Please, yes. So please state your name before you start. Thank you.
Chief Justice Bender, members of the court, Peter Gregory, registration number 10928 on behalf of the petitioner, Build It and They Will Drink. I will endeavor, perhaps unsuccessfully, to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal. The issue before the court is whether the Court of Appeals erred in holding that reasonable foreseeability, the proximate cause of the injury-causing event, is not an element of or an appropriate consideration in determining the liability of a licensee under 12-47-801. Now, although arguably this precise issue has not been addressed by this court, there is significant precedent from this court which sets forth the legislative intent behind the enactment of 12-47-801 and interprets how that statute should be applied. For purposes of argument, what I would like to do is address the facts quickly, then address the law, and then apply the law to the facts. The facts are that Respondent Strout was a patron at Build It's premises on January 1st, 2007. The assailant, Nathan Dickerman, was also a patron at the premises. Importantly, there is no evidence whatsoever in the record that there was any contact between them while at the bar, or that they had any prior relationship, or that there was any problem between them while we're at the bar. It was an open bar. It was a serve-yourself situation. At approximately 12:45 a.m., Strout left with his date to walk back to his hotel. They were about a block and a half away from the premises when they heard someone, later identified as Dickerman, yelling and screaming obscenities at cars. They continued walking. The noise came closer, and Mr. Strout turned around and saw a knife in Mr. Dickerman's hand. They turned, continued walking. The noise came even closer. Strout turned around, pushes his date out of the way, says, "Leave us alone," and turns to walk on. He then feels a sharp stabbing pain in his back, turns around, and gets stabbed in the stomach as well. Strout sued Build It and Build It's owner, Rodney Beers, as well as Dickerman. The issue before the court pertains only to Build It. The trial court granted summary judgment for both Build It and Beers on all claims. The trial court found that there was no duty which was owed, and that there was no knowledge by Build It, and thus no foreseeability that the act which did occur might occur. And the trial court further found that under the facts before it, imposing a duty would render the licensee a virtual insurer for all acts performed off the premises. The Court of Appeals reversed as to the statutory claim. It held that the common law doctrine of reasonable foreseeability does not apply to the statutory claim, and it said essentially that there were three elements of proof in order to hold the licensee liable. One, the willful and knowing sale or service to an underage or visibly intoxicated person. Two, intoxication due to that sale or service. And three, that the plaintiff suffered injuries because of the intoxication. This court then granted certiorari. Now, it is unquestionable that the 1986 enactment of the predecessor to 12-47-801 abolished all common law remedies against the licensee and replaced those remedies with statutory remedy. However, accepting that fact, this court is not writing on an empty slate. There is extensive Supreme Court precedent setting forth the legislative intent and interpreting that statute. In order to understand how that statute should be interpreted, we actually have to go back to what the common law said. The traditional common law rule was that there was no right of action against a vendor, and that the consumption of alcohol was the proximate cause of injuries suffered or caused by an inebriated person. Now, the common law, or that rule, became eroded over time, and a common law right was expressly recognized by this court in 1986 in Largo versus Crespin. However, the Largo court further noted the adoption of the predecessor to 12-47-801, although that statute had no impact on the Largo decision because the events therein predated the enactment of the statute. We then move forward to 1991, when this court announces Charlton versus Kamala, which was a social host liability case. In that case, this court held that the legislative intent in adopting the statute was to readopt the common law rule that consumption is the proximate cause of the injuries. The Charlton court significantly referenced the legislative history as specifically intending to assign legal responsibility to the person who chose to consume the alcohol. Now, it is this legislative intent which plays a key role in the resolution of the issue currently before the court. The concept of proximate cause and foreseeability is, in fact, expressly recognized in the statute.
Gregory, where?
Yes.
Where?
Oh.
Where in the statute?
In the exact language of the statute, which I thought I had right on top. And I do. The current version, Chief Justice Bender, is 12-47-801 and it's subsection 1. It says, the General Assembly hereby finds, determines, and declares that this section shall be interpreted so that any common law cause of action against a vendor of alcohol beverage is abolished, and that in certain cases, the consumption of alcoholic beverages, rather than the sale, service, or provision thereof, is the proximate cause of injuries or damages inflicted upon another by an intoxicated person, except as otherwise provided in this section. And I'm going to address how that statute's been construed by the court in a moment. So the General Assembly specifically recognizes the concept of proximate cause in the language used in the statute. The Court of Appeals opinion precludes the trial court from undertaking a foreseeability and proximate cause analysis. The Court of Appeals opinion essentially construes section 12-47-801 as preempting a proximate cause analysis. And under that rationale, the sale or service to a visibly intoxicated person is per se the proximate cause of injuries caused by a patron. Now, in the absence of that sale or service to a visibly intoxicated person, under the Court of Appeals rationale, the consumption of alcohol is the proximate cause.
Well, I want to stop you there and just ask you how you're reading the statute, because I guess I take it from your description of the Court of Appeals, and I think it's correct, is that basically that first section says we're abolishing the common law that this court recognized, essentially, but in certain cases we are recognizing that there's a proximate cause, and then it proceeds to list the certain cases that fill in that definition. I guess I'm wondering what do you find problematic in that reading of the statutory language? Why is that incorrect?
The reason that I would say that is incorrect was actually the next point I was going to make, which is this court has actually already interpreted the in certain cases language in Sigman versus Seafood. And what this court held was as follows. And I'm going to quote from the court's opinion. It's a 1991 case, and the court in that case was construing a number of constitutional challenges to the dram shop statute. And what the court said in interpreting the imprecision and purported vagueness of the certain cases language was the following. Under subsection 3A1, the sale or service of alcoholic beverages by a vendor may be the proximate cause of injuries inflicted on a third party by an intoxicated patron if the vendor willfully and knowingly sold or served any liquor to a minor or to a patron who was visibly intoxicated. Under subsection 4A, the provision of alcoholic beverages by a social host may be the proximate cause, etc. Then the court goes on to say, thus, the certain cases in which the consumption of alcoholic beverages is the proximate cause of injuries are all cases in which injuries resulting from intoxication, except those outlined in subsections 3 and 4A. The court was very careful to use words, which respondent calls pure sophistry, but the court used the words may and is. The court said that in certain instances it is the consumption that is the proximate cause, but the court further said that the sale or service to a knowingly intoxicated person only may be the proximate cause. And the reason that that interpretation is not a strained one and is correct is because you have to go back to what the intent of the General Assembly was in enacting the statute. And that is that it was to place the legal responsibility generally on the consumer of alcohol. Under the Court of Appeals rationale, section 12-47-801 essentially becomes a strict liability statute where proximate cause and foreseeability are totally removed from the analysis.
Oh, only in the limited circumstances, though, correct, where you've served someone who's visibly intoxicated or you've served an underage person. It's not always, proximate cause isn't always abolished, is it?
No. But I think my point is, and I pointed this out in the brief to draw this out, is if you do not superimpose the proximate cause analysis on the facts of a particular case, you could have far-reaching liability consequences on a licensee.
But very controlled, which is the point I think Justice Hyde is making, because it's actually knowingly serving underage or visibly intoxicated. So it certainly limits that liability or puts the limitation of that liability squarely in the hands of the tavern.
Well, I don't disagree with that point, but I think the point that I want to make is that when you look at what the intent of the General Assembly was, it was to bring back the common law rationale that it is the consumption of the alcohol that generally is the proximate cause for the damages that are caused. The situation that we face here is that under the reading of the Court of Appeals, which simply says the elements are the willful and knowing service to a visibly intoxicated person, you could have a situation where someone, this happened in Colorado Springs, they went up to the Air Force Academy, they hijacked a Cessna plane and they crashed it into a building, injuring or killing people. And there, the argument would be made, well, the bar willfully and knowingly served an intoxicated person, the bar is liable. The key here in my argument is that you have to go back to the common law analysis that the court uses in analyzing fact situations and superimpose that on the statutory analysis. When you do that, and I would commend the court, and I'm going to run out of time, but if you look at this court's...
But it seems as though we can only do that in light of the fact that this begins, as you have indicated, with the abolition of this common law tort. We can only do it if we can clearly find intent to return this common law, portions of this common law tort in the willful service category.
Yeah.
And you're locating that where precisely? I know the language of some of our prior decisions, which weren't necessarily focused on this problem.
That's true, but that's where I'm finding it, which is that there was an overriding intent to restore Colorado to what the common law rule was, i.e. the consumption is generally the proximate cause. And it's from that that then you can pull in, at least from an analytical point of view, the analysis of cases, like I pointed out in my brief, the Observatory Corporation versus, I believe it was Daily, which involved highly similar facts, i.e. an off-premises tortious act by an assailant. And this court held that as a matter of law, there was no duty owed and no proximate cause. If there are no further questions, I did not reserve any time.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Respondent? Just push lower the podium a little bit, so we can see. Thank you.
May it please the court, Drew Wills, Your Honor. I represent Michael Strout, who is the respondent here and was the plaintiff down below. My registration number is 13638. I'm here today because the petitioner in this case has asked this court to fling open the door on the common law, including proximate cause, and inject that into the exceptions of the statutory scheme, which begins with abolishing that common law. The argument that you just heard only can be made if you are willing to open the door once again to the common law in the exceptions that are created by the very statute that abolished them.
Just orient me here. I'm really having trouble with this because this isn't a crime. This is an intentional action. It's not a negligent action. I'm really having a hard time fitting it at all within the statute, why there'd be a cause of action because someone off a premises knifed somebody else. I'm sorry to inject that, but I don't understand why we're here.
Well, I certainly understand that, Your Honor, but let's take a look at things. Let's look at this statute, and let's look at the history of the common law, which I think is probably the analysis that causes you, perhaps, to think, to ask that question. The common law in Colorado originally was that there was no liability of an alcohol vendor. That then was, as counsel has told you, changed over the years, perhaps eroded, to the point where there were certain cases that could be brought against a tavern owner, and those involve all kinds of different situations that you might expect from the introduction of alcohol into human beings. Those things are loss of judgment, operating motor vehicles, and many cases like this one involving violence against others. That then, after the Largo versus Crespin case, was changed, and it was changed in a very particular manner by the legislature in Colorado. And it was done so in order to abolish that common law and to set the table clean and start anew. There is no question that all of that common law is abolished in the very first section of this statute. What is being argued now by the petitioner here is that they want to bring that back. There is a very clear statement of the abolishment of that common law, and all it is a restatement in that section of the idea that it is the person who is consuming that alcohol that is the person who is responsible, that the proximate cause is then attached to the person who's consuming that alcohol. Now, at the time the legislature adopted this statutory scheme, they then abolished all of that common law and they made two very specific exceptions to complete immunity of the tavern owner. And those two situations are when that tavern owner
is supplying or a social host, is supplying alcohol to someone who is under the age of 21 or someone who is visibly intoxicated. There was no, in those exceptions, there was no effort to bring back this idea of proximate cause and to add that element as an element of proof and then to come to the result which we came to in the trial court in this very case, where we have arguments of, well, how far did this take place? This act of violence or perhaps driving an automobile and injuring someone? Were they across town? Were they one block away? How much time ensued? All of those considerations then are not to be recognized under the new statute, Your Honor. What is to be recognized, however, are the second two elements that were recognized by the Court of Appeals. First, we have the knowing and willing service of alcohol to a visibly intoxicated person or someone who is under 21. That is compatible and consistent with all of the liquor laws throughout the state with regard to licensing tavern owners. But that is the first thing that must be proven, a very high standard. That is a higher standard than was required under the common law. We now have knowingly and willingly service of an invisibly intoxicated person. Then the second
counsel,
are also very important.
Hello. Yes. Can I just follow up on that element? Was there any question in this case that standard had been met about serving somebody who was visibly intoxicated?
Two things, Your Honor. That was conceded by the petitioner, not only here, but also in the appellate court, in the Court of Appeals, I'm sorry. And the reason that was conceded, Your Honor, is that this is a situation where a bar held an absolute free-for-all. There was a cover charge to go in, and there was unlimited bottle service to all of the participants who went into the VIP room, and all that was done were that continuous supplies of alcohol were brought into that room. There are a number of witnesses who have testified to the behavior that took place in that room and the amount of alcohol that was consumed. In this particular case, the assailant drank to the point of knocking furniture down, climbing up on tables and yelling at people, breaking light fixtures, leaving the establishment and throwing up and being allowed back into the establishment and continuing to consume alcohol. That was an egregious, wide-open, free-for-all drinking situation. If that situation, then, is allowed to occur just because we had a proximate cause analysis that would like to intervene in a later injury, then I think we have a major problem here. I think what the legislature was trying to do was to keep that sort of situation from happening. It was to put some responsibility on the person who had the alcohol in certain situations. We don't give that to underage.
Mr. Wills,
yes.
Where do we see that other than the language of the statute, which certainly is susceptible to the view that you are giving, but hardly is a model of clarity and certainly presents opportunity for other argument as well. Where else do we see it? And mindful of that, because we're looking for the intent of the legislature, you're saying it sort of had two intents. One was to cut back here, and the second one was to focus on these kind of violations of willful inappropriate service.
Yes.
Where do we see that intent?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the overall scheme is to abolish the common law, but then to create exceptions.
Well, let me get back to you on that, because
yes.
In describing the evolution of the common law, in a manner of speaking, there's sort of the earlier common law, which they were, and then what you referred to as perhaps the erosion of that. And so that had developed. And clearly they were responding to that development. Is it also so clear that they were also rejecting all the concepts of the earlier sort of notions in the common law that there wasn't drug shop liability?
I think, Your Honor, to accept the argument that is being made that the common law somehow still exists here other than to state that it is abolished is the problem.
But I don't, I'm not so sure that, I guess I'm not concerned about that. It's abolished. What I'm concerned about is, what does it show, what does that backdrop show about the legislative intent? And was the legislative intent to discard that in its entirety, or was it striking instead only at what you referred to as the erosions?
I think it was striking at the entire common law, which had at that point that the statute came into being, what I have referred to, or counsel has referred to, as the erosions of the idea that the proximate cause of the injury.
And why does it have that proximate cause language in the statute at all?
Simply to recognize the idea under the common law that the proximate cause is the ingestion of that alcohol by the individual. That is nothing but a restatement, I believe, Your Honor, of what that common law principle is. In order to accept what the petitioner here would like, you have to ignore the exceptions. You have to ignore those sections of the statute that create those exceptions.
Mr. Wells, what about what we said in Sigma? I understand your argument.
Yes.
Seems to me we're bound by that as a finding of what that statute means and what that exception means. I mean, we use those phrases.
Well,
that phrase may be the proximate cause. That's how we said it was constitutional.
Your Honor, if you continue to read that, what the petitioner has done is danced on the words maybe and may versus is in that sentence. But if you read the rest of that sentence, you're going to see if there is a knowing and willful service of alcohol. You have to read that entire sentence, and you can't take it out of context, which is what is being proposed by the petitioner here.
So any panoply of crime, including first-degree murder, because of alcohol service to an intoxicated person, becomes the liability of the shopkeeper.
And I didn't get to finish completely with you.
That'll take a long time.
I'm sorry. Yes.
I'll take that as a friendly comment.
I didn't mean to. I certainly didn't mean to not be.
I understand.
What I wanted to do was to refer to those second two elements, and it isn't just the proof of knowing involuntary service of an intoxicated person. There then are two other elements that have to be proven, and those were laid out by the Court of Appeals, and that is the intoxication has to have been caused by the service, and then the injury that is caused to a third person has to be as a result of the intoxication. So there are two causal elements that are also added in there. It is not simply a case where we throw causation completely to the wind. There are two more elements that must be proven.
Can I follow up on that? Those causal elements, are you talking about like cause and fact, the but-for cause? Is that what we're getting at?
Yes, Your Honor. That is what we're getting at. There was no, when we look at a statute, I believe that we have to first look at that statute to determine whether or not we have clear language. And it also seems to me we also have to take a look at what the law was and what was available at the time that those laws were passed with regard to the knowledge of the law. The word proximate is used in that statute. The legislature certainly understood what that word was and did not choose to use that down below in those exceptions, in those limited exceptions. So we have to assume that that was done on purpose. What the legislature has also done, I want to remind the court, is not just the higher standard of care and not just the two elements of causation, but we also have a situation where the statute of limitations has been restricted to 1 year, which is contrary to the common law, and we also have a limitation of damages, which is contrary to the common law. I believe I'm finished. Thank you very much.
The court will stand in recess until this afternoon at 1:30.